Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are spreading some information out there about dealing with public communication and persuasion and how to maybe up your game a little bit. Complicated times require more sophisticated techniques. And I would say these are complicated times. Seems like the discourse has changed with the rise of new modes of communication and such. So come on in, get your learn on a little bit and maybe pick up some new ideas. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, escaped professor. I'm also a late night comedy writer. So I tend to roam in different worlds. Founder of Rhetoric Warriors. You can find me over at Substack where I write on a lot of different topics about rhetoric, including persuasion for parents. If you'd like to apply some of this stuff to your children to make life easier, I'll talk to you about that. So here in the podcast, I do a few things. I talk to comedians about their politics and their careers because that's always interesting. I do conversions. So I will invite people on from very different perspectives than mine. And I will take them through my conversion process, especially conservatives, because they worry me. And I gather persuasion advice from academics and public persuaders and people with interesting expertises. And I would say that is today. My guest, I read an essay that he had written in a Substack on persuasion, and it really interested me from the way that he was approaching sort of the history of freedom of speech, which goes right into the core of all the things that he talked about in rhetoric. So I thought I would ask him on today. He's been all over the place. He's been a visiting fellow at a few different places in Washington, at the Individual Rights and Education in Washington. He was in the Columbia's Global Freedom of Expression Center. And right now he's sitting in his home of Copenhagen or outside of Copenhagen. So welcome, Jacob Michikama.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, that's kind of the nice thing about social media is you can sort of find interesting people and kind of get to them and kind of get access.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if the great philosophers of 100 or 200 years ago had the ability to sort of speak as freely and instantly as we are able to do now. You know, it's we take it for granted. We take it for granted, but you know, if people would be sort of thinking we live in some kind of dream world with the ability that we have, you know, sitting on two different continents and able to engage in what will hopefully be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, I remember watching some of the early in the 70s when people would start bringing on Foucault and, you know, people like that to have small debates or at least discussions. And after having read all that and then actually seeing these guys talk, it's just a completely different dimensionality to the information and the way that they communicate it.
Yeah. And you know, this is, I suspect, one of the things that we'll discuss, you know, how does new communications technology affect sort of the ecosystem of information and opinion? And what should we, you know, does that alter how we should think about freedom of expression? You know, is it a force for good or bad? And I think in our culture, at least it's sort of in open Western democracies, we tend to focus very much on the negative sides and on the bad things, and we tend to take all the benefits for granted. And I think that's one of the things that I hope to warn about. And perhaps we can talk about that. I have a book coming out on the history of free speech coming out in February. So that's an important part of what I think about. Yeah, when I think about free speech and use historical lessons and try to apply them to our challenges today.
Yeah, when you stretch it out and you start to look at it across eons and across cultures and all these different locations, this concept gets really pliable. You know, in some places, it's like you sort of said there at the beginning, it can be made to seem highly negative. It can be made to seem highly positive. And in rhetoric, that's just epideictic games of praise and blame. Like, how do you drag it over to the positive or the negative? And to see it, you know, this discussion of these two polarities of freedom of speech, because they're both there, right? There's clear harms that can be found in free speech, and there's clear goods. And so it's not a clean debate.
Yeah, no, I would say, some free speech defenders will say, sticks and stones and that, but I think it doesn't make sense to try to argue that, speech can never be harmful. Of course, speech can be harmful. But in my view, the benefits have historically, and even today, I would say, significantly outweighed the harms. And also, I think we think so much about the harms of free speech now is because they've become much more visible and they've been amplified because of social media. So before, before you had big centralized platforms, you would not typically, unless you sort it out, you would maybe not encounter white supremacy or, extreme ideologies. They would be hidden on specific corners of the internet where you would meet them. But today you can, you can be confronted by online trolls and so on. So you see the harms much more than you did before, where you had a much more privileged or elitist free speech environment, where you had institutional gatekeepers in professional journalists, editors, and there was a certain class that framed what was being said in the public debate. Of course, ordinary citizens also had the right to speak, but it would be very difficult for an ordinary person to speak to a larger audience, they would have to, have their say accepted by an editor, and that would require a specific format, or they would have to be invited on TV or the like. But I think it's also I think we tend to look back sometimes misty eyed at the days where everyone where there was a certain narratives that most people shared and we knew what was right and what was wrong. But I also think if probably a lot of the things that we accepted as truths and as the narrative of what was being reported in the New York Times or the Washington Post, if other voices had been allowed to share in the conversation the way they did today, we would maybe have very different perspectives on what was being reported. So it was partly because, there were only a few institutional actors that could actually frame what was being said before that it came across as the truth about what was being reported.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue, right? Like how much, it's almost a receiver issue. How much free speech can you take, can you absorb before it becomes cacophony, before it becomes sort of this avalanche and onslaught of different perspectives and people end up just shutting down? Because you see this a lot now on social media where people are, I've had, 50 friends in the last couple of months who say, I'm getting off social media. And that's become a way of adapting to this, because it is just so many voices, that's new, that's never been available before.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's a complete information overload. And also, if you want to research any given topic, you can find, you don't have one authoritative source, so it becomes more difficult to find the truth, and it becomes much easier for bullshit merchants to contest truth, and we see that, of course, with COVID and the election, the latest presidential election, and its contestation in the US, and the same phenomenon in many other places of the world. I think there's a French academic called Hugo Mercier who's written a great book. Now I forget the title, but he basically argues that people are not as gullible as we're sometimes, as you know, the narrative in media and so on will sometimes have us believe. He says that we actually have evolved with something that he calls an open vigilance. The book is called Not Born Yesterday. I really recommend it. And I think, you know, so if you look at, for instance, trust, there's no doubt that there's been sort of a collapse in trust in political institutions, in media, and so on. But still, in many countries, you will see that people have more faith in traditional media, in information on traditional media, than they do have faith in information on social media. And I think, you know, that's a healthy sign. Not that all traditional media outlets are perfect or don't engage in sort of misinformation and so on. But I think that shows that people are not just buying into the first narrative that they encounter on social media. And fortunately, we also see a lot of research about, you know, the share of hate speech and disinformation on social media. Even though the stories about misinformation on social media takes up a lot, and although the absolute number of pieces of content that include misinformation is obviously huge, it's actually quite a limited share. So most people are not, you know, buying everything, but obviously there's a very vocal minority that actively engages in sharing and disseminating hateful messages and misinformation. And unfortunately, they take up a lot of our debate, and they can have, you know, even though they're the actions of a minority, they can also ultimately lead to quite harmful consequences on the ground.
Yeah, it becomes a tangle, right? Very quickly. Like, this is a very tangled communication environment, a lot of issues that, you know, end up mixed up with each other. And when you look at it and try to clean it up in some ways, like part of my thing is I make a simple split in the brand that I do with rhetoric of calling it, I teach or advocate ethical only rhetoric versus, you know, the techniques which could fairly be fairly easily labeled as unethical rhetorical techniques. And that split at least allows people to intellectually cleave this massive storming of words and talk and parties and everything else, and at least do, you know, a beginning delineation between technique. So it gets that out there. It gets the idea that there's probably positive technique and negative technique, and there's a list of techniques which are acceptable and not acceptable. And it's completely, you know, a definitional play to try to get people to at least intellectualize the public discourse in some way. And I think that's what's interesting about, like, you know, when I read the description of your book, the reviews of your book that's coming out, even taking it down through history like you're doing and across cultures gives people a new perspective, a meta perspective on, like you said, what we take for granted here in the United States. Of course, you can say whatever you want, you know, which is definitely not true down through history or across cultures.
I think that's right. You know, the history of free speech to me, from a certain perspective, I think you could have sort of a short term and a long term perspective. So, in the long term perspective, we're living in an absolute golden age of free speech. So, you know, in the U.S., the legal protection of free speech has probably never been greater. So the U.S. Supreme Court affords a very, very high degree of protection of speech, even very sort of extreme and controversial speech. So it's very narrow categories of opinion that can be limited by public officials and the federal government and state governments and so on. Of course, you have challenges in the culture in the U.S. We see that both from the left and the right, but also just in terms of the digital age. You know, it's never been easier for people to just impart and receive information in ways that would have been unfathomable not long ago. But I think, in you know, from the short-term perspective, I still think that we're probably in the decline of a golden age, in the sense that in the past 10, 15 years, governments have adopted ever more restrictive laws against free speech. And also, sort of, even though the internet and social media were supposed to sort of, in the most techno-utopian civil libertarian ideals that sort of guided the early internet pioneers, and even social media companies like Twitter and Facebook initially, they have sort of hit the brick wall of reality, where they sort of come to realize that, you know, it's quite difficult being a platform with billions or hundreds of millions of users with very different ideas of what free speech is and what where the line should be drawn. And so these platforms have come to prioritize sort of safety of their users rather than free speech. And that means that at the practical level, we see free speech being increasingly limited by private companies, and we also see it, of course, at universities and colleges. We see it even among publishers, so on, where controversial cultural idea. Groups can cause, you know, a loss of livelihood, and of course we see authoritarians on the march all over the world. And you know, from you know, I date free speech back to the Athenian democracy some 2,500 years ago, and there you see that when the Athenian democracy was overthrown, the very first victim was free speech, and that is exactly the, you know, it's 101 in the dictators or the authoritarians playbook, that the very first thing you want to crack down on is free speech. You want to control the flow of information. You want to ensure that no one can challenge you in the public sphere. And we see that with China as the most prominent example. We see it with Russia. We see it with India. We see it in Hungary, even in Europe. We see it in Poland. But we even see it in liberal democracies as well. Increasingly, there's a narrowing space for free speech. So that's the decline of the golden age of free speech that I'm talking about. And that's what sort of has motivated me to write the book.
So what training do people get in this? Like, I know in America, like it's simply part of the culture. People use it or they don't. But, you know, the idea that there's so many different ways of setting up free speech, right? So you can do it where there's zero policing at all. There's some kind of mid-range policing, which what a lot of people cultures seem to be, or total policing, where you totally set up rules and there's a very hardened structure and everybody has to learn these and the consequences, usually from a government, you know. But I was a professor for 20 years, so there were clear speech restrictions within the norms of the institutions I worked for, even though they didn't come right out and say them. They were there. So there was always policing. So within that system of unpoliced versus totally policed, and we seem to, you know, move around there in the middle quite a bit. Where do you land on that? Like, is this sense of like the best things that you've seen are just completely unpoliced systems? Is that viable? Is that what you would?
No, I don't think, well, I would say that in general, my take from some sort of the history of free speech is that sort of decentralized authority when it comes to free speech tends to be a very strong, tends to create a fertile ground for free speech. So a good example of that could be sort of the golden age of the Dutch Republic in the 17th century. So there was no sort of there was no constitutional protection or laws that protected free speech, but because the Dutch republic had a number of states that competed with each other and had different rules. So that was a very, very weak central authority, which just allowed a practice of free speech, and therefore the Dutch Republic became sort of the printing house of Europe, and lots of printers could print things that would not be allowed in book to Europe. So that's a good example of sort of decentralized authority. You know, I do think that there should be rules, free speech would be undermined if the police did not take seriously and the legal system did not take seriously, for instance, threats. If threats were a perfectly acceptable remedy in the public debate, you know, someone writes something you don't like, and it was legal to say, "I'll kill you," then that obviously would undermine the very ideal and practice of free speech, and incitement to violence. And, you know, speech can be used in a lot of ways that are harmful, you know, embezzlement, fraud, you know, you could come up with numerous examples, but these are also examples where speech has a very clear nexus to some tangible harm. And that's where I tend to think the line should be drawn. That's not always crystal clear where the line should be drawn. But what I tend to oppose strongly is the regulation of mere opinions. So I think that voicing opinions, no matter how odious, should be allowed. So for instance, I would not criminalize Holocaust denial, even though Holocaust denial is almost by definition, a tool of sort of neo-Nazis who use it as a quote unquote clever way to sort of to engage in intelligent anti-Semitism and sort of rehabilitation of the crimes of the Nazis.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, so let's create a hypothetical system where you're the czar of free speech. Okay. So I've talked about this sometimes. Like, I think one of the roles of rhetoric is to be like guardians of the galaxy for public discourse, because rhetoricians become very highly attuned to all the issues that you're talking about, sort of how language works in the world. Right. And so you should turn to people like that to make some of these decisions. Governments aren't really qualified to make these decisions. Governments are hijackable. You know, all these systems that you're talking about, like, everybody would probably agree that inciting tangible harm or threats and things like that should be restricted in public speech. But as soon as you put that in there, then nefarious elements can come in and just claim that what you just said was a threat to them. You're seeing this all the time in the unethical practices of the right. So if you were the czar of this, like, I think rhetoricians can tell fairly easily ethical versus unethical, harmful versus non-harmful rhetoric, right? And I would imagine you probably could too.
I would not trust myself to be the sort of free speech czar. I think my principles on free speech are pretty good and pretty well informed, but undoubtedly my biases and sort of just having the power to sort of come down on one side or the other, I would use them to benefit and privilege my side of various debates, because humans have a great tendency to.
You really wouldn't trust yourself? You don't think that you would be one of the world's most educated people on free speech. Yeah, but, so you would be a great candidate for czar.
Yeah, but I don't think, like I said, I think free speech thrives when it, you know, there's decentralized authority, not when you know, that's a great, you know, we have examples of this. So, you know, in the 18th century, when the Enlightenment really got a foothold, you had these enlightened absolutists, they've been called, so like Frederick the Great and Katharina the Great, who you know, they were absolute rulers. Frederick was the absolute ruler of Prussia and Catherine was the absolute ruler of Russia, but they were sort of smitten with Enlightenment ideals and with Enlightenment thinkers, including sort of radical Enlightenment thinkers from France who really challenged prevailing ideas of religion, but also politics, and so both Frederick, who called himself a philosopher king, and Catherine, sort of tried to cultivate, sort of marry the idea of absolutism with Enlightenment, which included sort of opening up the space for free speech and debate. But they were never able to sort of, they were never willing to sort of completely let go of the inherent conflict and tension between free speech and the fact that they were absolutist rulers who got to decide everything. So whenever their position was challenged, you know, they'd have butts to free speech. And I'm sure if I'd been given those powers, you know, I could come up, I would come up with butts, and I would be able to convince myself with very sophisticated, beautifully written words that this or that opinion was really harmful. It might not seem like it was a deviation of the principles that I have previously espoused, but because of this specific argument, I could justify it. So I don't think that
you're positing the corrupted you, not the best you, right?
Yeah, but all human beings are corruptible. I think we're you know, I simply don't believe any one person with all that power. I think it would take, you know, superhuman powers to keep your path clean when you were given those kinds of powers. So I wouldn't want those kind of powers. Of course, it might be better to have me given those superpowers than others who would have no hesitation about, you know, imposing hardcore restrictions. But
right.
But
so right now, like Zuckerberg and, you know, all these tech giant guys, tech founders are essentially playing that role in their massive universe. So he's got the metaverse now, and he's playing the dictator of free speech, what's allowed and what isn't. I'd rather have you there than him.
But again, this is a good example. So Twitter used to call themselves the free speech wing of the free speech party. And I think, you know, since I think they sincerely believed, you know, in Silicon Valley that they would sort of create these platforms that would be informed by sort of First Amendment ideals and American free speech ideals. And then, you know, then suddenly, you know, you become listed, you have shareholders, you have pressure, you have to satisfy politicians of one stripe, of another stripe, you have, you know, you've got pressure from NGOs, and so on, and then you know your principles become flexible because you realize that free speech, you know, cannot be the only guiding principle for a company that is ultimately whose main mission is profits.
So capitalism is destroying free speech.
No, I wouldn't say that capitalism is destroying free speech. I would certainly say that the capitalist countries have a much stronger record on free speech than the socialist ones. I don't think there's ever been a country that so systematically denied free speech as the Soviet Union, especially during Stalin, but already commencing under Lenin. I think quite likely Stalin was more censorious than Hitler, even though Hitler was certainly no fan of free speech.
He was busy with other things. He was busy repressing other things.
He was busy, but you know, Stalin was also quite fond of repressing various. But Stalin is interesting because he basically served as a censor himself. So he would sort of spend hours sort of pouring through draft articles and manuscripts and screen films, and then he would give sort of friendly advice to editors and writers, and then you'd better accept his advice if you cared about your career, your liberty, and ultimately your life, because if you didn't, you could ultimately end up in some gulag or with a bullet in the back of your head. So capitalism can undermine free speech because profits don't always go hand in hand with free speech. But I wouldn't say that capitalism is inherently in conflict with the free speech. It can also enhance it in some ways.
Well, don't you think those guys, and this again, why I'm going to keep dragging you back onto the throne as the czar of free speech. Those guys are in over their heads. They don't get the kind of training in the background that you do, that you have from, doing the research and thinking about this for years and years and having discussions like this. So we have people, and this is one of the, I found very interesting, especially in business, people making decisions outside their area of competence. Zuckerberg is in no way competent to make this decision.
No, and essentially no one really is. So my organization, we did, so last year, no, actually earlier this year in June, I think, we published a survey of attitudes towards free speech in 33 countries across the globe. And what you'll see is that when you ask people around the world whether they think free speech is an important value, I think something like 94% will say yes, and that people should have the right to say what they want. But then when you ask them about specific questions, you see huge differences between different countries based on culture, religion, geography, and also within certain countries. So you generally see like Scandinavian countries and the US are the populations in those countries are the most speech protected. So they will say that free speech should include the right to offend minorities and offend religion. But in a number of countries like, say, Pakistan, Russia, Kenya, very, very few, a tiny minority will accept free speech like that. So there is no sort of, where do you come down on this? And that's the problem with these centralized platforms, is they want to cater to the whole world, but people across the world have very, very different ideas about what free speech should be. So where do you set the line? Should it be in Denmark and Sweden and Norway? Should it be our sort of tolerance threshold, which is very, very high? Or should it be, people in Russia and Kenya, who have very different ideas about what's the proper role of free speech, and when so you cannot satisfy everyone, and that's why I think that free speech is ultimately not served by these centralized platform. I think social media would benefit from a much more decentralized model, sort of a bit like going back to the original internet, or at least sort of like the blogosphere. When blogs were sort of all the rage, no one cared if you had sort of a neo-Nazi white supremacist blog that had 50 or 100,000 people reading it, because that would just be sort of a tiny community. It wouldn't, it wouldn't pop up everywhere. And so they could just have that corner of the internet to themselves. But now, when we have sort of centralized platforms whose terms and community standards sort of define global, the limits for global conversations and the sharing of information across most countries in the world, that becomes much more problematic, because ultimately there is no ideal that will satisfy everyone. That simply does not exist, because we don't have the same ideas about where free speech should be. You don't even have that in the US, because of even though the US is one of the most has one of the most speech protective populations in the world, you can still see a lot of the division and polarization that your country is suffering from now on issues on free speech. So if you're a if you're a liberal progressive Democrat, you'll be more open to the idea that that minorities should be protected from hate speech, for instance. You'll be more open to hate speech being prohibited by the government. Whereas if you are a nationalist conservative, you will say that free speech should not protect the burning of the flag, for instance, or now, as we see in several states, sort of critical race theory. We believe in free speech, but critical race theory that should be banned at least in schools and colleges. So even in a country like the U.S., where you know free speech is sometimes celebrated as sort of a secular article of faith, even though in reality, you know, the American legal protection of free speech is a relatively recent phenomenon, and there's been lots of censorship and repression throughout the history of the U.S. Then you see that that polarization and division is reflected in what's free speech among Americans.
Yeah. So there's the push to try to come up with universal ideas that apply to free speech, right? Like if you were to recommend, here are my top five things that I think make for a healthy free speech environment. Like here are the anchors I would put into the world versus this idea that when you start going into the particulars, it all breaks apart. When you start going across other cultures, it all breaks apart. So how do you do a universalism? Because I assume part of your expertise and the time you spent with this, you've come up with ideas of your own, like here's what I think makes for a healthy functioning free speech system.
Yeah, well, I think basically you have to go a bit behind, you know, the mere principle and say, you know, why even have free speech? What is free speech good for? And I would argue that one of the, in the US, for instance, one of the ideas that is challenging free speech from parts of the population that would previously have been staunch proponents of free speech is this idea that free speech is now being weaponized against minorities, against oppressed groups, and maybe against democracy itself. And that's why I would say, okay, so if you care, you know, if you care not just about freedom, but also equality and justice, and you say those values have to go hand in hand, then I would say, you know, okay, in which way has free speech impacted equality and justice? And, you know, if you go to American history, I don't think, you know, I think free speech has probably been one of the most crucial engines for equality. And that, you know, it's probably one of the most crucial consequential engines of human equality that human beings have ever stumbled upon. So if you go back to, let's go back to the 1830s, for instance, and where you had abolitionist organizations in the North that started petitioning and writing sort of abolitionist pamphlets and mailing them to the South, sort of saying, you know, this can't go on. We have to, you have to abolish this evil that is slavery. And how did Southern states react? Well, they adopted probably the most speech restrictive laws in the history of the United States. So in places like Alabama and I think one of the Carolinas, I believe, there was a death penalty for circulating abolitionist tracts. And sort of even sort of possessing it or sharing abolitionist ideas would be prohibited. And of course, one of my favorite free speech proponents was the great orator and who was born a slave, Frederick Douglass, who escaped slavery and became sort of a very prominent abolitionist orator and journalist. And he said, in a very memorable speech, that the right to free speech is very important, especially for the oppressed. So he saw sort of a very clear, he saw a very clear connection between free speech and equality and the emancipatory power of free speech. And I think you saw, you see that also with someone like Ida B. Wells, who was maybe one of the most brave journalists in the history of the US. So she's a Black woman who in the South sort of exposes lynchings and reports about them and has a newspaper that is ultimately burnt to the ground, and she has to flee to the North because she's exposing this lie that the reason why African-American men are being lynched is what this is the white sort of trope is that they are raping white women, and so she exposes this through her incredibly brave journalism. So that's the power of free speech. You see it with the civil rights movement, who, you know, one of the reasons why free speech is so strongly protected in the US today is because the civil rights movement went on this spree of landmark decisions that they won at the Supreme Court, culminating with New York Times versus Sullivan in 1964, that greatly expanded the protection of free speech, which empowered the civil rights movement to openly protest the gross injustices of Jim Crow laws. And you know, it's the same with British colonialism. So someone like Gandhi was sentenced to 6 years in prison. He gave a great speech during his trial where he really stood up for the principle of free speech and went against these British sedition laws that the British used to shut down anti-colonialist movements. You saw it in apartheid South Africa, which used a whole battery of laws of censorship and repression to try and quell the anti-apartheid movement. And just before winning the first free presidential election in 94, Nelson Mandela gave this great speech where he lauded the idea of free speech and how the free press in democracies had given a voice to those anti-apartheid activists who could not speak their mind in South Africa, and how that had helped bring about the end of apartheid. So if you really believe in inequality, and if you're concerned about minorities, I would say free speech is the very first right that you should be concerned about, because it has always been the most important weapon for those who are oppressed, and it has always been the preferred tool of the oppressor and the supremacists. So
I was going to say, so then does the issue, like, I think everybody would agree that free speech is a super weapon. It's a super tool for the oppressed and for people who need to get perspectives out. So is the problem then, like, it's when good people use it, it's fine. But then when bad people come along and use it, it becomes not fine? Because even free speech, like, I know with what's going on a lot right now with dark money in politics and the Supreme Court saying giving money is free speech from a corporation, that is completely opened up a vulnerability in democracy here, where, you know, because they warped the definition, I think, of free speech, and let bad people hide behind the power of, you know, the protection of it. So is that the issue? Like, yeah, there are good things and bad things that can be done with this, but really it comes down to, are good people using it or bad people using it?
Yeah, one of the problems with that is, of course, that some of the people that we laud today were very bad at their time. And that's why they were subject to all kinds of censorship and repression. But it is unavoidable, you know. So if you believe in principled, robust free speech protections that I do, as I do, and I say, well, these are crucial for minorities, then someone might say, how is that when white supremacists are allowed to march through the streets and spew their hatred, because this will undermine the equality of minorities, and this is harmful to them. And I would not deny that sort of that hate speech, you know, speech is difficult to define. That's one of the problems with policing it, because it's a very flexible tool in the hands of authorities. But I would not deny that harm speech can be harmful in a number of ways. So it can be harmful and disproportionately hurtful to minorities that are targeted and might feel more vulnerable. So there can be sort of psychological, emotional harms from being subjected to hate speech. And ultimately, you know, even though I think the correlation between hate speech and hate crimes is quite tenuous, but you know, it would be impossible to organize a genocide or a pogrom or the like without speech. Speech is a necessary component for demonizing groups before people set upon them. But I think the problem is one, as I mentioned, the definition. How if you allow the government to police hate speech, you know, imagine in the U.S.
I don't want the government doing it. I want you doing it.
But I think that's ultimately what is the strongest weapon. That is showing solidarity, and that's why also in my book towards the end I say that, you know, if you believe that free speech, even hate speech, should be protected by free speech standards, you have a moral obligation to use your own speech rights to counter racism and hate speech and extend solidarity to those who are targeted by hate speech, because otherwise it becomes a bit gratuitous just to say, well, yes, free speech, but so you also have to show, and I think there are a number of strategies that are much more effective than government repression. I show, for instance, in my book that in Weimar Germany, sort of from 1918 to 1933, there was a sort of increasingly draconian laws that were being used both against Nazis and communists. You know, from confiscation of newspapers to banning Hitler from speaking in public to sentencing Nazi editors to jail, to sort of only allowing government-friendly broadcasts on the radio, and ultimately the Nazis used the very provisions in the Constitution that were supposed to protect democracy to subvert democracy. So I think this idea of militant democracy, where democracy says no, there are limits to what you can say and how opposed to democratic values you can be, I think that's a dangerous road. But you know, there's also in the U.S. you have the Westboro Baptist Church, which is this group of religious fundamentalist cranks who used to show up at funerals of soldiers dead who had died, you know, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and they would show up and shout sort of anti-LGBT things and anti-Catholic things. And so at one point, a house became available across the street from the Westboro Baptist Church, and someone bought it and painted it in sort of rainbow colors, so the LGBT flag. I thought that was a very, very creative example of using the power of speech and symbolism to counter hatred. There were some in Germany who also, so you had these neo-Nazis who were marching in the streets, and unbeknownst to these skinhead thugs who were roaming around the streets in their march shouting hateful things, this anti-racist organization that worked to de-radicalize the neo-Nazis had created this fundraiser. So for every, I think it was every kilometer or so that these Nazis marched, donors would contribute an amount of money. And so when they showed up towards the end, these neo-Nazis, they showed these flags and posters saying, congratulations, you've just donated X amount of euros to an organization. That really is a way to humiliate the racists. But of course, it's also important that authorities, you know, even if authorities say, yes, you can say hateful things, but it's incredibly important that you then draw the line at intimidation and threats, so you're allowed to say hateful things, but you don't get to stand outside a mosque or a synagogue or the like and shout death to the Jews and the Muslims, where sort of whipping up a crowd.
So your system would be then, it sounds like, maybe creative countering, like everybody needs to take on a responsibility to protect free speech or keep it, you know, as healthy as possible by countering what you consider to be, you know, negative speech. But the government or whatever the reigning body is does have some responsibility for doing some kind of legal control, like a mix of those two things.
I think you have to crack down on threats. For instance, threats is a major impediment to free speech. If you know, as I think I mentioned earlier on, if you were free to just simply call your a politician that you didn't like, or someone, a journalist or a reporter, and say, you know, if you keep writing negatively about this or that subject, I'm going to kill you, or, you know, I'm coming after your kids, then that would be a very efficient way to undermine free speech and impose sort of a self-censorship among those who are threatened. So that's something that really has to be policed and vigorous. And I think, especially in the digital age, you know, I think there's a, because it's become so easy to threaten someone just by leaving a comment on social media or shooting off an email, there might be this idea among people that it's not so serious to threaten people online. But I think, you know, that's one issue where I think we have to be vigilant about, policing online content is sort of threats.
Right. But that becomes problematic too, right? Like, I've seen this a lot with social media now, where they, you know, they've set their bots to recognize certain phrases and certain terms.
And, yeah, for sure.
You know, like I did a bunch of research. I get interested in different intellectual areas, and then I research all the interesting trivia and background information about it, and then marry it up with stand-up and create one-person shows. And one of the ones I did was Hitler, because Hitler was such an odd moment in human history and such an odd character. And so I have a ton of Hitler jokes, you know, that, you know, they're from the right perspective, the correct perspective. I'm not advancing Hitler, but whenever you mention Hitler on Twitter or Facebook, you can just feel the, you know, the bots coming on going, is this,
yeah.
And they don't get irony.
Yeah, no. And that's one of the, and again, I think that, again, that has to do with the fact that we have these very centralized platforms. So there's just no way, you know, even if Facebook and Twitter and YouTube limited, you know, even if they adopted sort of very speech protective terms that reflected
did we lose you?
First Amendment standards, yeah. Which is they would, you know, no amount of human moderators could keep up with the number of comments that would have to be moderated. So it's just in the nature, you know, content moderation at scale just requires automation. But at the same time, automation, you know, from a free speech perspective, is not a great tool, just because, you know, at the current level of sophistication, it's difficult for them to get context, and you know, irony, and, you know, for instance, if you are a minority group, you might use slurs to use those slurs as a way to take away the sting of them.
It's literally, that's incredibly common in,
and social media. So very often social media will not get that it's being used, the slur is being used in such a way, or it might be in sort of an anti-racist organization sort of saying, oh, this person said this, to sort of expose someone bigoted, and social media, and and the algorithm will not be able to figure out that it was used in such a way because it cannot sufficiently understand context. So that's a huge problem. And again, I think it might be that automation at some point becomes better and more reliable than the humans who will develop them. I don't know. I'm not a computer scientist. But I think, again, if we had a much more decentralized social media environment, it would not be so consequential because you would not, to the same extent, need to be dependent on automated content moderation. But at the same time, I also think, you know, that to a higher degree, you know, one way where you could try to have more decentralized content moderation is to allow people to be more in control of the content that they're confronted with. You could, for instance, Facebook could allow, so if you're someone who's very concerned about racism, you could say, okay, I'll have the I'll have some anti-racist organization create a filter, and then I can sort of use that. I can have I can apply that on Facebook, and so that will filter a lot of terms that I find to be racist. But that does not apply to everyone. That's just me. That's my preference. And someone might say, I'm very concerned about misogynism. There's a number of terms used by what I consider to be misogynist trolls that I do not want to be confronted with, so I'll apply that. So that would allow, you know, more people to be in control and charge of what they're being confronted with without this being a centralized decision taken from the top and affecting everyone.
Right. So everybody has individual censorship power.
Yeah, and I think that's perfectly compatible with free speech. So, you know, we're all selective about speech. You know, you don't necessarily accept the friendship of everyone on social media. You might unfollow or delete friends. You might even block them if you think they're being if you think they're being annoying. You know, you every day you make decisions about, you know, am I going to read this newspaper or that newspaper, dependent on the ideas and that are being reflected in that newspaper, and the same with literature and films. So that is just part and parcel of free speech, and that's not problematic in any way, because that's just you using, you know, discriminating for yourself, but not right, with effects for everyone else.
And I've made this point quite a bit to people because, again, doing stand-up pushes the limits of what can be said. It likes to break taboos. It likes to explore shock and extremes. And my point to people a lot of times is you can say whatever you want. Like, I'm completely for free speech. I don't care how ugly it is. I don't care how extremist it is or anything else. I don't even care if it's threats and violence, stuff like that. What I care about is you can't force me to receive it. Like, if you're just saying it over there, I'm fine with you and your orb, but like, you don't, I'm not giving you permission for it to reach me, you know? Yeah. So that's a lot of what I do when I curate my social media. I'm like, I accept no negativity in my social media. If you want to laugh at the jokes, great. If you want to say something funny or, you know, in praise of the jokes, great. No questions, no discussion, no debate. It's just a joke. Because I don't want that type of speech coming to me. And so I feel like I should have the power to determine that. And I think that's what people lose a lot. Like, I think capitalism does this with advertising, with mass, you know, dispersive advertising. Politics does it right now with mass, you know, like the problem with Trump getting on Twitter was that everybody had to experience that. Suddenly he had a way of getting messages out to everybody, even people who didn't want to hear it. So empowering the individual to control their reception, I think, is a really interesting area to look at.
Yeah, and you know, obviously there are dangers in the sense that, you know, it could potentially lead to sort of filter bubbles and echo chambers. But, you know, in a certain sense, it doesn't really differ conceptually from, you know, do you prefer the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times? You know, it might be,
yeah,
you know,
aesthetic choices very, at that point.
And also, you know, you might say, I really disagree with the editorial line of the Wall Street Journal. I much prefer the New York Times. So I'm going to subscribe to the New York Times, or vice versa. And you know, you might want to watch MSNBC and not Fox, or the other way around. And that's your choice. But it becomes more problematic the more centralized these decisions become, and impacting sort of the ecosystem of information and opinion for a lot of people.
Well, and I think part of my background has been entertainment, and that's kind of what I studied as an academic. Entertainment has dealt with a lot of this stuff for a long time and has come up with interesting solutions, like even the rating systems for films, or the fact that films are so highly advertised with a poster and with trailers and things like that. So you can see what it is before you decide to actually go in and experience that message. And that's literally, like, you could do that with all free speech, like any group saying something like, oh yeah, they're neo-Nazis and this is how they talk, and here's a little trailer of it, and here's a rating. If you want it, go get it. But if you want to avoid it, then you are empowered to do that. And I think entertainment, if you look at big media systems, you know, when you're trying to solve problems like that, like, you don't, one of the problems stand-up has is people walk in a lot of times to a comedy club and they don't know the comedians that are going to be up there. And there's suddenly a big mismatch on profanity or topics. And you see people all the time will walk out of comedy clubs because they're offended by something. Whereas if there's a rating system that explained, hey, if you're coming in here, this is what you're going to get, they could have avoided it. And I think interesting things like that, like where you pull it from another, ecology, another ecosystem, would be interesting to add into public, you know, general public discourse.
Sure. I mean, again, if it was like, I wouldn't be happy with the idea of sort of a centralized agency that should sort of label things, even if you were allowed to read them. But, you know, but obviously, you know, the way that algorithms, for instance, on social media recommend things is another thing. You know, one often criticism against Facebook, for instance, is that their algorithms tend to reward in engagement and thus the most controversial stuff. I think probably it's a bit more complicated than that, but there's probably some and a lot of truth to that. So it might be that Facebook has to think about, you know, can we have an algorithmic ranking system that maybe does not just reward engagement and the most sensationalist content. That would not mean that this content is unavailable, but it would just mean that other forms of content would be more visible.
Or if you could have some influence on it, right? Like, again, going back to the idea of the individual with power over their messaging. Here's 25 algorithms that we use. Choose the one you want to use.
Yeah.
Right now they're imposing an algorithm on us.
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, each of these ideas and options probably open up a can of worms and include, you know, a whole list of dilemmas and pros and cons. So I don't think there's any. Quick fix or easy of the digital age, you know, if you go back to look at what happened when the printing press was introduced, you know, these periods of tend to create a lot of chaos and uncertainty, and we have to learn how to navigate in the digital age according to sort of our analog brains and cultures and norms and customs, and so maybe it'll be our grandkids who come up with a viable culture of free speech and debate for the 21st century.
Yeah, it is fascinating the way the cultural communication technologies come in and just explode everything. Like, all of a sudden, like, how do we do this? The fact that, you know, everybody remembers the day that Trump got de-twittered because the silence fell over the entire world that hadn't been there for 5 years. I remember sitting going, oh, I'm not as upset today, you know, because that one voice had been pulled out of the world ecology. And that's a pretty amazing experience. That's never really been available like that before, ever. Instant communication with pretty much the whole world from a questionable source. So, well, cool, man. I appreciate you jumping on. I don't want to keep you too long. Great discussion, as I figured.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah. And tell people once again, when is your book coming out and when can they find that?
Yeah. So my book is Free Speech, A History from Socrates to Social Media. It will be out published by Basic Books. It'll be out on February 8th. And I'll be touring the US for 3 weeks at least in February. So on the East Coast, mostly DC, New York, I think. So look out for it. If you live somewhere where I'll be speaking, show up and let's have a great discussion.
Yeah, and show up and bring a big poster that says Jacob for Czar of Free Speech. That's what I want. That's what I want to put forth out there. Well, like I said, great discussion. I appreciate it very much. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and persuade people, engage. As always, we all need it. So do it.